a piece of dirt, and a piece of gold as having equal value. When Siddhartha reached enlightenment, he didn't make time stop or reach to the end of time. He simply was no longer stained by the concept of time. When we say Siddhartha removed all obscurations of time and space, it is not that he broke the time machine or physically dismantled a compass. He went completely beyond all concepts of time and space. Although the actual experience of going beyond time and space is unfathomable to us time slaves, it is possible to get a sense of the elasticity of these concepts within our mundane existence. Even a romantic crush can stretch and bend time. We meet someone, we daydream about becoming soulmates, getting married, having children, and even grandchildren. But then, something like a bit of saliva dripping out of a loved one's mouth snaps us back to reality, and all those future generations vanish. Because the advantages of going beyond space and time are so incomprehensible, we are not drawn to understand them. We are too accustomed to the world that depends on time and space to exert ourselves for such intangible rewards. It may be easier to grasp the aspect of enlightenment that is beyond emotional distinctions of good and bad, pleasure and pain, praise and criticism, and other dualistic emotions. Our reliance on space and time is understandable. They are very useful for now, but these other distinctions are useless to the point of absurdity. Dualism has us so entangled that we spend millions of dollars every year to keep up appearances. If we were wandering alone in the desert, there would be no point in looking fabulous. So obviously we want to make ourselves look good in relation to others, to attract them, to compete with them, to be accepted by them. When someone says, "Oh, you have nice legs," we are thrilled and continue preening and fishing for compliments. These compliments are like honey on a sharp knife. Many of us are so engrossed with our own concepts of beauty that we don't perceive that our version of what is attractive may actually repel others. We fall victim to our own concepts and to our vanity. This vanity feeds the cosmetic industry, which is one of the causes and conditions that literally destroys the environment. When we receive a good amount of praise peppered with a little criticism, all of our attention goes to the criticism. Compliments are taken for granted because of our insatiable appetite for praise. One who desires unending praise and attention is like a butterfly trying to find the edge of the sky. No distinctions, no concepts, no leash. Along with conventional concepts of time and space, Buddha dropped all subtle emotional dualistic distinctions. He had no preference for praise over criticism, gain over loss, happiness over unhappiness, fame over obscurity. He was not swayed by optimism or pessimism. One did not have a stronger attraction or warrant a greater investment of energy than the other. Imagine no longer falling prey to small praises and criticisms, hearing them as Buddha did, as mere sounds, like an echo. Or hearing them as we would on our deathbed. We might take some pleasure in listening to our loved ones praise how beautiful and wonderful we are, but at the same time, we would be detached and unaffected. We would no longer cling to the words. Imagine being above bribes and other persuasions because all worldly temptations seem uninteresting, like a salad to a tiger. If we couldn't be bought by praise or defeated by criticism, we would have incredible strength. We would be extraordinarily free. There would be no more unnecessary hopes and fears, sweat and blood, and emotional reactions. We would finally be able to practice, "I don't give a damn." Free from chasing after and avoiding other people's acceptance and rejection, we would be able to appreciate what we have in the present moment. Most of the time, we are trying to make the good things last, or we are thinking about replacing them with something even better in the future, or we are sunk in the past, reminiscing about happier times. Ironically, we never truly appreciated the experience for which we are nostalgic because we were too busy clinging to our hopes and fears at the time. Where we are like children at the beach, busy building sandcastles, sublime beings are like adults, watching from under an umbrella. The children are carried away with their creations, fighting over shells and shovels, terrified of the waves coming closer. They go through all kinds of emotions. But the adults lie nearby, sipping a coconut cocktail, watching, not judging, not feeling pride when a sandcastle is built very nicely, and not feeling anger or sadness when someone accidentally steps on the turret. They are not caught up in the drama the way the children are. What more enlightenment could one ask for? The closest simile to enlightenment in the secular world is freedom. In fact, the concept of freedom is a driving force in our personal lives and our societies. We dream of a time and place where we can do whatever we like, the American dream. In our speeches and our constitutions, we chant freedom and the rights of the individual like mantras, yet deep down we don't really want them. If we were granted total freedom, we probably wouldn't know what to do with it. We don't have the courage or the ability to take advantage of true freedom because we are not free from our own pride, greed, hope, and fear. If everyone were to suddenly vanish from the earth except for one person, we can imagine total freedom for that person. He could shout and walk around naked, break the law, even though there would be no law and no witness. But sooner or later, he's going to get bored and lonely and wish for companions. The very idea of relationship requires giving up some of our freedom to the other. So if the lone man's wish comes true and he's granted one companion, it's likely the companion will do as he or she pleases and may very well compromise his freedom, intentionally or unintentionally. Who's to blame? The lone man, for it was his own boredom that invited his downfall. Without boredom and loneliness, he could still be free. We do a good job of limiting our freedoms. Even if we could, we would not walk around in our birthday suit or wear a dead fish as a tie at a job interview because we want to impress people and win friends. We may not explore alternative or ethnic cultures, however much wisdom they offer, because we don't want to be branded as hippies. We live behind bars of responsibility and conformity. We make a big issue of individual rights, privacy, the right to bear arms, and free speech, but we don't want to live next door to a terrorist. When it comes to others, we want to impose a few rules. If others are totally free, you may not get everything you want. Their freedom could limit your freedom. When trains are blown up in Madrid and buildings in New York are reduced to rubble, we blame the CIA for letting terrorists roam freely. We think it's the government's job to protect us from bullies. But the bullies and terrorists see themselves as freedom fighters. Meanwhile, we want to be politically correct and holders of justice, so if our ethnic-looking neighbor is nabbed by the federal agents, we may protest. It is especially easy to be politically correct about issues that are far removed from us. Either way, there's a risk of becoming the victims of our own political correctness. Renunciation. The sky is the limit. If we are serious about achieving enlightenment, we need the strength to renounce the things that are a big deal for us, and we need a great deal of courage to step onto the path alone. Those who do not pursue praise and gain, those who do not shun criticism and loss, may be stigmatized as abnormal or even insane. When observed from an ordinary point of view, enlightened beings may seem insane because they don't negotiate, they cannot be lured or swayed by material gain, they don't get bored, they don't look for thrills, they have no face to lose, they do not conform to rules of etiquette, They never employ hypocrisy for personal gain. They never do things to impress people, and they don't display their talents and powers just for the sake of it. But if it benefits others, these saints will do anything necessary, from having perfect table manners to leading a Fortune 500 company. In 2,500 years of Buddhist history, there have probably been countless enlightened beings who were never identified or who were banished for being insane. Very few were appreciated for possessing what we call crazy wisdom. But when we think about it, we are the ones who are really insane, falling head over heels for echo-like praise, brooding over criticism, and grasping at happiness. Forget about going beyond time and space. Even going beyond praise and criticism seems out of reach. But when we begin to understand, not only intellectually but emotionally, that all compounded things are impermanent, then our grasping lessens. Our conviction that our thoughts and possessions are valuable, important, and permanent begins to soften. If we were to be informed that we have only 2 days left to live, our actions would change. We would not be preoccupied with putting our shoes in line, ironing our underwear, or stockpiling expensive perfumes. We might still go shopping, but with a new attitude. If we know, even a little bit, that some of our familiar concepts, feelings, and objects exist only as a dream, we develop a much better sense of humor. Recognizing the humor in our situation prevents suffering. We still experience emotions, but they can no longer play tricks on us or pull the wool over our eyes. We can still fall in love, but without fear of being rejected. We will use our best perfume and face cream instead of saving them for a special occasion. Thus, every day becomes a special day. Buddha's qualities are inexpressible. They are just like the sky, which has no end in space. Our language and our analytical powers can only go as far as the concept of the universe. At some point, a bird that flies higher and higher to find the end of the sky will reach its limit and have to return to Earth. The best metaphor for our experience in this world is an epic dream that has a number of complex, intertwining stories, ups and downs, dramas, and thrills. If an episode of the dream is fraught with devils and beasts, we hope to escape. When we open our eyes to see the fan turning on the ceiling, we are relieved. For the sake of communication, we say, "I dreamed the devil was chasing me," and we feel relief at having escaped the clutches of the devil. But it is not as if the devil has gone away. The devil never entered your room during the night, and while you were having that hideous experience with him, he also was not there. When you are awake into enlightenment, you have never been a sentient being. You have never struggled. From then on, you do not have to be on guard against the devil's return. When you become enlightened, you cannot think back to when you were an ignorant being. No more meditation is needed. There is nothing to remember because you have never forgotten anything. As Buddha said in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, all phenomena are like a dream and an illusion. Even enlightenment is like a dream and an illusion. And if there is anything greater or grander than enlightenment, that, too, is like a dream and an illusion. His disciple, the great Nagarjuna, wrote that the Lord Buddha has not stated that after abandoning samsara there exists nirvana. The non-existence of samsara is nirvana. A knife becomes sharp as the result of two exhaustions, the exhaustion of the whetstone and the exhaustion of the metal. In the same way, enlightenment is the result of the exhaustion of defilements and the exhaustion of the antidote of the defilements. Ultimately, one must abandon the path to enlightenment. If you still define yourself as a Buddhist, you are not a Buddha yet. Conclusion. These days, we often encounter people who mix and blend religions to suit their comfort level. Trying to be non-sectarian, they attempt to explain Christian concepts from Buddha's point of view, or to find similarities between Buddhism and Sufism, or between Zen and business. Of course, one can always find at least small similarities between any two things in existence, but I don't think such comparisons are necessary. Even though all religions begin with some kind of philanthropic aim, usually to relieve suffering, they have fundamental differences. They are all like medicines, and like medicines, they are designed to reduce suffering, but they vary depending on the patient and the ailment. If you have poison ivy, the proper treatment is calamine lotion. If you have leukemia, you don't try to find the similarities between calamine lotion and chemotherapy so that you can justify applying calamine lotion because it's more convenient. Similarly, there's no need to confuse religions. In these chapters, I have attempted to provide a glimpse into the fundamentals of the Buddhist view. In all religions, the view is the foundation of the practice, because the view determines the motivation and actions. It's so true that appearances can be deceiving. We truly can't judge our next-door neighbors solely by the way they look. So, obviously, we can't judge something as personal as religion by superficial appearance. We can't even judge religions by the actions, ethics, morality, or codes of conduct they promote. The view is the final reference point. The view is the core of any religion. At an interfaith conference, we may have no choice but to be diplomatic and agree that all religions are basically the same. But in fact, they have very different views, and no one but you yourself can judge if one view is better than the other. Only you, as an individual, with your own mental capacity, taste, feelings, and upbringing, can choose the view that works for you. Like an abundant buffet, the variety of approaches offers something for everyone. For example, the Jain message of ahimsa is so beautiful that one wonders why this great religion is not flourishing like other religions. And the Christian message of love and salvation has brought peace and harmony to the hearts of millions. The outward appearance of these religions can seem foreign and illogical to outsiders. Many of us are understandably apprehensive about age-old religions and superstitions that lack apparent reason. For example, many people are puzzled by the maroon robes and shaved heads of Buddhist monks because they seem irrelevant to science, economy, and life in general. I can't help wondering what such people would think if they were transported to a Tibetan monastery and faced with paintings of wrathful deities and naked ladies in sexual positions. They might think they were seeing some exotic aspects of the Kama Sutra, or even worse, evidence of depravity or demon worship. Outsiders might also be appalled at seeing Jain practitioners walking naked or Hindus worshipping gods that resemble cows and monkeys. Some find it difficult to understand why Muslims use their profound philosophy of forbidding idol worship as justification for demolishing the sacred icons of other religions, while in Mecca, one of Islam's most sacred sites, the Kaaba, Hajar al-Aswad, the sacred black stone, is a physical object of worship and the destination of millions of Muslim pilgrims each year. For those who have no understanding of Christianity, it may be inconceivable why the Christians don't pick a story out of Christ's heyday rather than his most gloomy episode on the cross. They may find it incomprehensible that the central icon, the cross, makes the Savior seem so helpless. But these are all appearances. Judging or valuing a path or religion by such appearances is not wise, and it can foster prejudice. Strict conduct can't be used to define a religion either. Adherence to rules does not make a good person. It is believed that Hitler was a vegetarian and very careful about his grooming. But discipline and smart outfits are not in themselves holy. And who determines what is good in the first place? What is wholesome in one religion is unwholesome or inconsequential in another. For example, Sikh men never cut their hair and beards, whereas monks in both Eastern and Western traditions often shave their heads, and Protestants can do as they please with their hair. Each religion has profound explanations for their symbols and practices, why they don't eat pork or prawns, why they are required to shave or prohibited from shaving. But within these infinite do's and don'ts, each religion must have a fundamental view, and that view is what matters most. The view is the final reference point to determine whether or not an action is justifiable. Action is valued by how well it complements one's view. For example, if you live in Venice Beach, California, you have the view that it's good to be slim. Your motivation is to lose weight. You meditate on the beach about how nice that would be, and your action might be to avoid carbohydrates. Now, suppose you're a sumo wrestler in Tokyo. Your view is that it's good to be enormously fat. Your motivation is to gain weight, and you meditate on how you can't be a skinny sumo wrestler. Your action is to eat as much rice and donuts as possible. The act of eating a donut is therefore good or bad, depending on your view. Thus, we can mistakenly consider someone who abstains from meat to be a compassionate person, when actually their view is simply that meat is bad because it raises their cholesterol. Ultimately, no one can judge other people's actions without fully understanding their view. All methods of Buddhism can be explained with the four seals. All compounded phenomena are impermanent. All emotions are pain. All things have no inherent existence. And enlightenment is beyond concepts. Every act and deed encouraged by Buddhist scriptures is based on one of these four truths, or seals. In the Mahayana Sutras, Buddha advised his followers not to eat meat. Not only is it non-virtuous to bring direct harm to another being, but the act of eating meat does not complement the four seals. This is because when you eat meat, on some level you are doing it for survival, to sustain yourself. The desire to survive is connected to wanting to be permanent, to live longer at the expense of the life of another being. If putting an animal into your mouth would absolutely guarantee an extension of your life, then, from a selfish point of view, there would be reason to do so. But no matter how many dead bodies you stuff into your mouth, you are going to die one of these days. Maybe even sooner. One may also consume meat for bourgeois reasons, savoring caviar because it's extravagant, eating tiger's penises for virility, consuming boiled bird's nests to maintain youthful-appearing skin. One cannot find a more selfish act than that. For your vanity, a life is extinguished. In a reverse situation, we humans cannot even bear a mosquito bite, let alone imagine ourselves confined in crowded cages with our beaks cut off, waiting to be slaughtered, along with our family and friends, or being fattened up in a pen to become human burgers. The attitude that our vanity is worth another's life is clinging to the self. Clinging to the self is ignorance. And as we've seen, ignorance leads to pain. In the case of eating meat, it also causes others to experience pain. For this reason, the Mahayana Sutras describe the practice of putting oneself in the place of these creatures and refraining from eating meat out of a sense of compassion. When Buddha prohibited consumption of meat, he meant all meats. He didn't single out beef for sentimental reasons or pork because it's dirty, nor did he say that it's okay to eat fish because they have no soul. The beautiful logic of the four seals. As an example of the first seal, impermanence, consider generosity. When we begin to realize the first truth, we see everything as transitory and without value, as if it belonged in a Salvation Army donation bag. We don't necessarily have to give it all away, but we have no clinging to it. When we see that all our possessions are impermanent, compounded phenomena, that we cannot cling to them forever, generosity is already practically accomplished. Understanding the second seal, that all emotions are pain, we see that the miser, the self, is the main culprit, providing nothing but a feeling of poverty. Therefore, by not clinging to the self, we find no reason to cling to our possessions, and there is no more pain of miserliness. Generosity becomes an act of joy. Realizing the third seal, that all things have no inherent existence, we see the futility of clinging, because whatever we are clinging to has no truly existing nature. It's like dreaming that you are distributing $1 billion to strangers on the street. You can give generously because it's dream money, and yet you are able to reap all the fun of the experience. Generosity based on these three views inevitably makes us realize that there is no goal. It is not a sacrifice endured in order to get recognition or to ensure a better rebirth. Generosity without a price tag, expectation, or strings provides a glimpse into the fourth view, the truth that liberation, enlightenment, is beyond conception. If we measure the perfection of a virtuous action, such as generosity, by material standards, how much poverty is eliminated, we can never reach perfection. Destitution and the desires of the destitute are endless. Even the desires of the wealthy are endless. In fact, the desires of humans can never be fully satisfied. But, according to Siddhartha, generosity should be measured by the level of attachment one has to what is being given and to the self that is giving it. Once you have realized that the self and all its possessions are impermanent and have no truly existing nature, you have non-attachment, and that is perfect generosity. For this reason, the first action encouraged in the Buddhist sutras is the practice of generosity. A deeper understanding of karma, purity, and non-violence. The concept of karma, the undeniable trademark of Buddhism, also falls within these four truths. When causes and conditions come together and there are no obstacles, consequences arise. Consequence is karma. This karma is gathered by consciousness, the mind, or the self. If this self acts out of greed or aggression, negative karma is generated. If a thought or action is motivated by love, tolerance, and a wish for others to be happy, positive karma is generated. Yet motivation, action, and the resulting karma are inherently like a dream, an illusion. Transcending karma, both good and bad, is nirvana. Any so-called good action that is not based on these four views is merely righteousness. It is not ultimately Siddhartha's path. Even if you were to feed all the hungry beings in the world, if you acted in complete absence of these four views, then it would be merely a good deed, not the path to enlightenment. In fact, it might be a righteous act designed to feed and support the ego. It is because of these four truths that Buddhists can practice purification. If one thinks that one is stained by negative karma, or is weak or sinful, and is frustrated, thinking that these obstacles are always getting in the way of realization, then one can take comfort in knowing that they are compounded and therefore impermanent and thus purifiable. On the other hand, if one feels lacking in ability or merit, one can take comfort knowing that merit can be accumulated through performing good deeds, because the lack of merit is impermanent and therefore changeable. The Buddhist practice of nonviolence is not merely submissiveness with a smile or meek thoughtfulness. The fundamental cause of violence is when one is fixated on an extreme idea, such as justice or morality. This fixation usually stems from a habit of buying into dualistic views, such as good and bad, ugly and beautiful, moral and immoral. One's inflexible self-righteousness takes up all the space that would allow empathy for others. Sanity is lost. Understanding that all these views or values are compounded and impermanent, as is the person who holds them, violence is averted. When you have no ego, no clinging to the self, there is never a reason to be violent. When one understands that one's enemies are held under a powerful influence of their own ignorance and aggression, that they are trapped by their habits, it is easier to forgive them for their irritating behavior and actions. Similarly, if someone from the insane asylum insults you, there's no point in getting angry. When we transcend believing in the extremes of dualistic phenomena, we have transcended the causes of violence. The Four Seals, a package deal. In Buddhism, any action that establishes or enhances the four views is a rightful path. Even seemingly ritualistic practices, such as lighting incense or practicing esoteric meditations and mantras, are designed to help focus our attention on one or all of the truths. Anything that contradicts the four views, including some action that may seem loving and compassionate, is not part of the path. Even emptiness meditation becomes pure negation, nothing but a nihilistic path, if it is not in compliance with the four truths. For the sake of communication, we can say that these four views are the spine of Buddhism. We call them truths because they are simply facts. They are not manufactured. They are not a mystical revelation of the Buddha. They did not become valid only after the Buddha began to teach. Living by these principles is not a ritual or a technique. They don't qualify as morals or ethics, and they can't be trademarked or owned. There is no such thing as an infidel or a blasphemer in Buddhism, because there's no one to be faithful to insult, or to doubt. However, those who are not aware of or do not believe in these four facts are considered by Buddhists to be ignorant. Such ignorance is not cause for moral judgment. If someone doesn't believe that humans have landed on the moon or thinks that the world is flat, a scientist wouldn't call him a blasphemer, just ignorant. Likewise, if he doesn't believe in these four seals, he is not an infidel. In fact, if someone were to produce proof that the logic of the four seals is faulty, that clinging to the self is actually not pain, or that some element defies impermanence, then Buddhists should willingly follow that path instead. Because what we seek is enlightenment, and enlightenment means realization of the truth. So far, though, in all these centuries, no proof has arisen to invalidate the four seals. If you ignore the four seals but insist on considering yourself a Buddhist merely out of a love affair with the traditions, then there is superficial devotion. The Buddhist masters believe that however you choose to label yourself, unless you have faith in these truths, you will continue to live in an illusory world, believing it to be solid and real. Although such belief temporarily provides the bliss of ignorance, ultimately, it always leads to some form of anxiety. You then spend all your time solving problems and trying to get rid of the anxiety. Your constant need to solve problems becomes like an addiction. How many problems have you solved only to watch others arise? If you're happy with this cycle, then you have no reason to complain. But when you see that you will never come to the end of problem solving, that is the beginning of the search for inner truth. While Buddhism is not the answer to all the world's temporal problems and social injustices, if you happen to be searching, and if you happen to have chemistry with Siddhartha, then you may find these truths agreeable. If that is the case, you should consider following him seriously. Richness within renunciation. As a follower of Siddhartha, you don't necessarily have to emulate his every action. You don't have to sneak out while your wife is sleeping. Many people think that Buddhism is synonymous with renunciation, leaving home, family, and job behind, and following the path of an ascetic. This image of austerity is partly due to the fact that a great number of Buddhists revere the mendicants in Buddhist texts and teachings, just as Christians admire St. Francis of Assisi. We can't help being struck by the image of the Buddha walking barefoot in Magadha with his begging bowl, or Milarepa in his cave, subsisting on nettle soup. The serenity of a simple Burmese monk accepting alms captivates our imagination. But there's also an entirely different variety of follower of the Buddha. King Ashoka, for example, who dismounted from his royal chariot, adorned with pearls and gold, and proclaimed his wish to spread the Buddha Dharma throughout the world. He knelt down, seized a fistful of sand, and proclaimed that he would build as many stupas as there were grains of sand in his hand. And in fact, he kept his promise. So one can be a king, a merchant, a prostitute, a junkie, a chief executive officer, and still accept the four seals. Fundamentally, it is not the act of leaving behind the material world that Buddhists cherish, but the ability to see the habitual clinging to this world and ourselves, and to renounce the clinging. As we begin to understand the four views, we don't necessarily discard things. We begin instead to change our attitude toward them, thereby changing their value. Just because you have less than someone else doesn't mean that you are more morally pure or virtuous. In fact, humility itself can be a form of hypocrisy. When we understand the essenceless and impermanence of the material world, renunciation is no longer a form of self-flagellation. It doesn't mean that we're hard on ourselves. The word sacrifice takes on a different meaning. Equipped with this understanding, everything becomes about as significant as the saliva we spit on the ground. We don't feel sentimental about saliva. Losing such sentimentality is a path of bliss, sugata. When renunciation is understood as bliss, the stories of many other Indian princesses, princes, and warlords who once upon a time renounced their palace life become less outlandish. This love of truth and veneration for the seekers of truth is an ancient tradition in countries like India. Even today, instead of looking down on renunciants, Indian society venerates them just as respectfully as we venerate professors at Harvard and Yale. Although the tradition is fading in this age when corporate culture reigns, you can still find naked, ash-clad sadhus who have given up successful law practices to become wandering mendicants. It gives me goosebumps to see how Indian society respects these people instead of shooing them away as disgraceful beggars or pests. I can't help but imagine them at the Marriott Hotel in Hong Kong. How would the nouveau riche Chinese, desperately trying to copy Western ways, feel about these ash-clad sadhus? Would the doorman open the door for them? For that matter, how would the concierge at the Hotel Bel Air in Los Angeles react? Instead of worshipping the truth and venerating sadhus, this is an age that worships billboards and venerates liposuction. Adopting wisdom, dropping distorted moralities. As you hear this, you may be thinking, I'm generous, and I don't have that much attachment to my things. It may be true that you aren't tight-fisted, but in the midst of your generous activities, if someone walks off with your favorite pencil, you may get so angry that you want to bite his ear off. Or you may become completely disheartened if someone says, "Is that all you can give?" When we give, we are caught up in the notion of generosity. We cling to the result. If not a good rebirth, at least recognition in this life, or maybe just a plaque on the wall. I have also met many people who think they are generous simply because they have given money to a certain museum, or even to their own children, from whom they expect a lifetime of allegiance. If it is not accompanied by the four views, morality can become similarly distorted. Morality feeds the ego, leading us to become puritanical and to judge others whose morality is different from ours. Fixated on our version of morality, we look down on other people and try to impose our ethics on them, even if it means taking away their freedom. The great Indian scholar and saint, Shantideva, himself a prince who renounced his kingdom, taught that it is impossible for us to avoid encountering anything and everything unwholesome. But if we can apply just one of these four views, we are protected from all non-virtue. If you think the entire West is somehow satanic or immoral, it will be impossible to conquer and rehabilitate it. But if you have tolerance within yourself, this is equal to conquering. You can't smooth out the entire earth to make it easier to walk on with your bare feet, but by wearing shoes, you protect yourself from rough, unpleasant surfaces. If we can understand the four views not only intellectually but also experientially, we begin to free ourselves from fixating on things that are illusory. This freedom is what we call wisdom. Buddhists venerate wisdom above all else. Wisdom surpasses morality, love, common sense, tolerance, and vegetarianism. It is not a divine spirit that we seek from somewhere outside of ourselves. We invoke it by first hearing the teachings on the four seals, not accepting them at face value, but rather analyzing and contemplating them. If you are convinced that this path will clear some of your confusion and bring some relief, then you can actually put wisdom into practice. In one of the oldest Buddhist teaching methods, the master gives his disciples a bone and instructs them to contemplate its origin. Through this contemplation, the disciples eventually see the bone as the end result of birth, birth as the end result of karmic formation as the end result of craving, and so on. Thoroughly convinced by the logic of cause, condition, and effect, they begin to apply awareness to every situation and every moment. This is what we call meditation. People who can bring us this kind of information and understanding are venerated as masters because, even though they have profound realization and could live happily in the forest, they are willing to stick around to explain the view to those who are still in the dark. Because this information liberates us from all kinds of unnecessary hiccups, we have an automatic appreciation for the explainer. So, we Buddhists pay homage to the teacher. Once you have intellectually accepted the view, you can apply any method that deepens your understanding and realization. In other words, you can use whatever techniques or practices help you to transform your habit of thinking that things are solid into the habit of seeing them as compounded, interdependent, and impermanent. This is true Buddhist meditation and practice, not just sitting still as if you were a paperweight. Even though we know intellectually that we're going to die, this knowledge can be eclipsed by something as small as a casual compliment. Someone comments on how graceful our knuckles look, and the next thing we know, we're trying to find ways to preserve these knuckles. Suddenly, we feel we have something to lose. These days, we are constantly bombarded by so many new things to lose and so many things to gain. More than ever, we need methods that remind us and help us get accustomed to the view, maybe even hanging a human bone from the rear view mirror, if not shaving your head and retreating to a cave. Combined with these methods, ethics and morality become useful. Ethics and morality may be secondary in Buddhism, but they are important when they bring us closer to the truth. But even if some action appears wholesome and positive, if it takes us away from the four truths, Siddhartha himself cautioned us to leave it be. The tea and the teacup. Wisdom within culture. The four seals are like tea. While all other means to actualize these truths, practices, rituals, traditions, and cultural trappings are like a cup. The skills and methods are observable and tangible, but the truth is not. The challenge is not to get carried away by the cup. People are more inclined to sit straight in a quiet place on a meditation cushion than to contemplate which will come first, tomorrow or the next life. Outward practices are perceivable, so the mind is quick to label them as Buddhism, whereas the concept, all compounded things are impermanent, is not tangible and is difficult to label. It's ironic that evidence of impermanence is all around us, yet is not obvious to us. The essence of Buddhism is beyond culture, but it is practiced by many different cultures, which use their traditions as the cup that holds the teachings. If the elements of these cultural trappings help other beings without causing harm, and if they don't contradict the four truths, then Siddhartha would encourage such practices. Throughout the centuries, so many brands and styles of cups have been produced, but however good the intention behind them and however well they may work, they become a hindrance if we forget the tea inside. Even though their purpose is to hold the truth, we tend to focus on the means rather than the outcome. So people walk around with empty cups, or they forget to drink their tea. We human beings can become enchanted, or at least distracted, by the ceremony and color of Buddhist cultural practices. Incense and candles are exotic and attractive. Impermanence and selflessness are not. Siddhartha himself said that the best way to worship is by simply remembering the principle of impermanence, the suffering of emotions, that phenomena have no inherent existence, and that nirvana is beyond concepts. On a superficial level, Buddhism can seem ritualistic and religious. Buddhist disciplines such as maroon robes, rituals and ritual objects, incense and flowers, even monasteries have form. They can be observed and photographed. We forget that they are a means to an end. We forget that one does not become a follower of Buddha by performing rituals or adopting disciplines such as becoming vegetarian or wearing robes. But the human mind loves symbols and rituals so much that they are almost inevitable and indispensable. Tibetan sand mandalas and Japanese Zen gardens are beautiful. They can inspire us and even be a means to understanding the truth. But the truth itself is neither beautiful nor not beautiful. Although we can probably do without things like red hats, yellow hats, and black hats, there are some rituals and disciplines that are universally advisable. One cannot definitively say that it is wrong to meditate while lying in a hammock and holding a drink garnished with a small umbrella, as long as you are contemplating the truth. But antidotes, such as sitting up straight, actually have great benefit. Correct posture is not only accessible and economical, it has the power to deprive your emotions of their usual quick reflex that engrosses you and sends you adrift. It gives you a little space to become sober. Other institutionalized rituals such as group ceremonies and religious hierarchical structures may have some benefit, but it is important to note that they have been the targets of sarcasm of past masters. I personally think that these rituals must be the reason why many people in the West categorize Buddhism as a cult, even though there isn't the smallest trace of cultishness in the Four Truths. Now that Buddhism is flourishing in the West, I have heard of people altering Buddhist teachings to fit the modern way of thinking. If there is anything to be adapted, it would be the rituals and symbols, not the truth itself. Buddha himself said that his discipline and methods should be adapted appropriately to time and place. But the Four Truths don't need to be updated or modified, and it's impossible to do so anyway. You may change the cup, but the tea remains pure. After surviving 2,500 years and traveling 40,781,035 feet from the Bodhi tree in central India to Times Square in New York City, the concept, all compounded things are impermanent, still applies. Impermanence is still impermanence in Times Square. You cannot bend these four rules. There are no social or cultural exceptions. Unlike some religions, Buddhism is not a survival kit for living that dictates how many husbands a wife should have, or where to pay taxes, or how to punish thieves. In fact, strictly speaking, Buddhists don't even have a ritual for wedding ceremonies. The purpose of Siddhartha's teaching was not to tell people what they wanted to hear. He taught because of his strong impulse to release others from their misconceptions and endless misunderstandings of the truth. However, in order to effectively explain these truths, Siddhartha taught with different manners and means according to the needs of his different audiences. These different ways of teaching have now been labeled as different schools of Buddhism. But the fundamental view for all schools is the same. It is normal for religions to have a leader. Some, such as the Roman Catholic Church, have an elaborate hierarchy led by an all-powerful figure to make decisions and pass judgments. Contrary to popular belief, Buddhism does not have such a figure or institution. The Dalai Lama is a secular leader for the Tibetan community in exile and a spiritual master to many people all over the world, but not necessarily for all Buddhists. There is no one authority with the power to decide who is a true Buddhist and who is not for all the forms and schools of Buddhism that exist in Tibet, Japan, Laos, China, Korea, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, and the West. No one can declare who is punishable and who is not. This lack of a central power may bring chaos, but it is also a blessing because every source of power in every human institution is corruptible. Buddha himself said, "You are your own master." Of course, if a learned master makes the effort to present the truth to you, you are a fortunate being. In some cases, such masters should be revered even more than the Buddha, because although thousands of Buddhas may have come, for you, this person is the one who brought the truth to your doorstep. Finding a spiritual guide is entirely in your own hands. You are free to analyze him or her. When you are convinced of the master's authenticity, accepting, enduring, and enjoying him or her is part of your practice. Respect is often confused with religious zeal. Because of unavoidable outward appearances, and also because of the lack of skill of some Buddhists, outsiders may think that we are worshiping Buddha and the lineage masters as though they were gods. In case you are wondering how to decide which path is the right path, just remember that any path that doesn't contradict the four truths should be a safe path. Ultimately, it is not the high-ranking masters who guard Buddhism, but the four truths that are the guardians. I cannot emphasize enough that understanding the truth is the most important aspect of Buddhism. For centuries, scholars and thinkers have taken full advantage of Siddhartha's invitation to analyze his findings. Hundreds of books scrutinizing and debating his words are evidence of that. In fact, if you are interested in Buddhism, far from the threat of being labeled a blasphemer, you are encouraged to explore every doubt. Countless intelligent people have come to respect Siddhartha's wisdom and vision first. Only then do they offer their trust and devotion. It is for this reason that, once upon a time, princes and ministers didn't give a second thought to abandoning their palaces in the quest for truth. Practicing harmony. Profound truths aside, these days even the most practical and obvious truths are ignored. We are like monkeys who dwell in the forest and shit on the very branches from which we hang. Every day, we hear people talking about the state of the economy, not recognizing the connection between recession and greed. Because of greed, jealousy, and pride, the economy will never become strong enough to ensure that every person has access to the basic necessities of life. Our dwelling place, the earth, becomes more and more polluted. I have met people who condemn ancient rulers and emperors and ancient religions as the source of all conflict. But the secular and modern world has not done any better. If anything, it has done worse. What is it that the modern world has made better? One of the main effects of science and technology has been to destroy the world more quickly. Many scientists believe that all living systems and all life support systems on Earth are in decline. It's time for modern people like ourselves to give some thought to spiritual matters, even if we have no time to sit on a cushion, even if we are put off by those who wear rosaries around their necks, and even if we are embarrassed to exhibit our religious leanings to our secular friends. Contemplating the impermanent nature of everything that we experience and the painful effect of clinging to the self brings peace and harmony, if not to the entire world, at least within your own sphere. As long as you accept and practice these four truths, you are a practicing Buddhist. You might read about these four truths for the sake of entertainment or mental exercise, but if you don't practice them, you are like a sick person reading the label on a medicine bottle but never taking the medicine. On the other hand, if you are practicing, then there is no need to exhibit that you are a Buddhist. As a matter of fact, if it helps you to get invited to some social functions, it is totally fine to hide that you are a Buddhist. But keep in mind that as a Buddhist, you have a mission to refrain as much as possible from harming others and to help others as much as possible. This is not a huge responsibility, because if you genuinely accept and contemplate the truths, all these deeds flow naturally. It's also important to understand that as a Buddhist, you do not have a mission or duty to convert the rest of the world to Buddhism. Buddhists and Buddhism are two different things, like Democrats and democracy. I'm sure that many Buddhists have done and are doing awful things to themselves and others. But it is encouraging that until now, Buddhists have not waged war or ransacked the temples of other religions in the name of the Buddha for the purpose of religious proselytizing. As a Buddhist, you should stick with this policy. A Buddhist should never engage in or encourage bloodshed in the name of Buddhism. You cannot kill so much as one insect, let alone a human being. And if you happen to learn of an individual Buddhist or a group that is doing so, then as a Buddhist you must protest and condemn them. If you keep silent, you are not only not discouraging them, you are basically one of them. You are not a Buddhist.
This has been an Audible Studios production of What Makes You Not a Buddhist? Written by Zongsar Jamyong Kensei. Performed by Tom Pyle. Executive Producer, Susie Bright. Producer, Mike Charsik. Copyright 2007 by Zongsar Jamyong Kensei. Production copyright 2014 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.